Please rise. Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larkin, Judge Johnson, Judge Rasmussen, with the Honorable Michelle A. Larkin presiding.
Thank you. Please be seated. Final case on the court's calendar this morning is Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus versus Tim Walls and Mary Moriarty. We're ready for arguments in the case. I'll note for the record that we do make an oral recording of this hearing, so each attorney should be sure to state his or her name for the record before each leg of the argument, so we have your identification for that recording. That is the only recording that is permitted unless a prior authorization has been obtained from the court to record the proceedings or to even have recording devices such as cell phones or laptops present in the courtroom. We have granted one such request on behalf of the media today. No one else should be recording anything. With that, we are ready for arguments from appellant. Each side will have 15 minutes for principal argument. Appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Of course, allowing for any questions the court may have, we may choose to exceed those time limits. You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, Emily Anderson, Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of the state. I want to be clear that the gun owners won below. The district court severed and voided the provision that they challenged. But the gun owners are asking this court for more than just to win. They are asking for a sweeping remedy that is basically unprecedented in Minnesota's history of single subject challenges. For the reasons we've explained in our brief, and in part because of the sweeping nature of that challenge, we think that this shows why Minnesota courts should put some guardrails around single-subject litigation, specifically by applying the codification rule, which is just a sensible rule that says if you are injured by the way a bill was enacted, that you should bring that challenge shortly after enactment and not sit on your known rights for years while the state of play has coalesced and reliance interests have accrued. And of course, we are preserving our political question argument for review. But I think the real issue for this court is that remedy issue. The gun owners seek full invalidation of the 2024 omnibus bill. But that is just not the law on remedy. The law on remedy is severance. And if that is going to change in Minnesota, that change needs to come from the Minnesota Supreme Court. Otto v. Wright County showed courts how they should analyze single-subject challenges. It looked to the challenged provision and the bill's subject as expressed in its title, and it said if those two are connected, there is no violation of the single-subject clause. If they are not connected, then you sever and void the challenged provision. That's the germaneness test, and Otto said repeatedly that that is the only test in Minnesota for a single subject challenge. Otto also was crystal clear about the remedy if germaneness is violated. It is to sever the challenged provision. It said that is the proper remedy to a single subject challenge.
Ms. Anderson, is it your position that part two of Associated Builders has been overruled in whole or in part?
No, I don't believe that Associated Builders has been overruled. I think Otto said what the holding of Associated Builders was, which is severance is the proper remedy. And I think if you read Associated Builders and the gun owner's brief, their position on what Associated Builders means does not come from the text of Associated Builders. Associated Builders doesn't say anywhere in it that if the great weight of provisions are not connected to each other, then you invalidate the entire bill. You are not going to find those words in Associated Builders. And it is not what Minnesota courts understand. I'm sorry.
Excuse me for that, but back to that point. The respondents are focusing on the last sentence of the opinion, which says where or if the common theme of the law is clearly defined by its other provisions, then a provision that does not have any relation to that common theme is not germane or void. Does that rule still survive?
Yes, that rule survives, that in the circumstances submitted by or considered by Associated Builders, that's the rule. If you read to the end of that sentence, there's a footnote, though. That footnote says is footnote 34, and it specifically says, we do not decide cases not before us. To me, that means that that sentence means what it says, and it does not mean the inverse of what it says, that in a different case, we would fully invalidate the law.
Just as a matter of analysis, I mean, do you agree with your opposing counsel that a court must identify the common theme?
I guess I think that the court must identify a common theme, but I think Otto told you how to do that, and it's to look to the bill's title. Again, when we are talking about single subject, the single subject clause, that is the core business of lawmaking. The single subject clause is entrusted to Article 4, the legislative department. This is sort of the legislature at its apex. The legislature has its prerogative to define the subject of its laws. And that's a theme that comes from case law going back 150 years, that the legislature can choose a broad subject if it wants, that this is the legislature's prerogative to define its work.
Didn't the Otto Court look at the various titles of that act to determine its germaneness?
I don't think so. What the Otto Court did was say that the subject of the bill was state government operations because that was the phrase immediately following relating to in the bill's title. Here, following that convention, it's relating to
Excuse
the
me,
operation.
I meant to say articles. Didn't the Otto Court, my mistake, didn't the Otto Court look at sort of the various articles and the subjects of each article or the sub-subjects, if you wish, of each article but before determining the germaneness question?
No, I think what the Otto Court did was summarize the arguments of counsel of the plaintiffs and amici in that case that said there are so many various provisions in this omnibus bill that it can't possibly have a single subject. That is what plaintiffs said in Otto. That is what plaintiffs are saying here. The Otto Court said the subject of the bill is relating to state government operations. Again, transposing that into this situation, the subject of the bill is relating to the operation and financing of state government. Otto also said, we do not look to provisions not before us. We do not strike down germane provisions of law because some provisions may not be germane. We stick to what is in front of us. And that makes good sense. Justiciability principles don't go out the window just because we're in single subject land, so to speak. The gun owners challenged the binary trigger ban. They are the gun owners' caucus. That makes good sense for them to be challenging. That is what they have standing to challenge. That's what they have established standing to challenge. And so under Otto, the court's analysis is very narrow. It is you look to that provision and you determine whether or not it is germane to the bill's subject. We've done a little bit of that work for you because the state has conceded that the binary trigger ban is not germane to the operation and financing of state government. So then Otto tells you what to do, and it's exactly what the district court did in this case, which is to sever and void the offending provision. That's what this court has done since Associated Builders. It's, in fact, what the Minnesota Supreme Court did before Associated Builders.
Is that what the court should do if there is no common theme? I mean, in Otto, we had a bill with one subject in the title. Here, arguably, there are two subjects in the title. I understand that issue is not before us, but the argument is you sever the provision that's not germane. What if nothing's germane because there is no one common theme? What do you do then? What's the argument that the remedy should still be limited to severing the challenge provision?
So I think I'm going to answer that in two ways, the first of which is that we do think that this is a one-subject bill. And again, under Otto, we think that state government operations is a totally acceptable subject. I think it was...
Again, that issue's not before us in this case.
Right. Then, because we have a one-subject bill, any provision, I believe the district court in this case sort of invited thousands of challenges. If there was nothing that was germane to the subject that the legislature chose, then it would be up to the court in every challenge to say that. But that is the nature of litigation. We do not do advisory opinions. We do not look to cases that aren't before us. And here, there are certainly many, many provisions of this bill that are germane to the operation and financing of state government. There are appropriations provisions, as the gun owners have pointed out. Those are clearly germane to the operation and financing of state government. There is, in another case before this court, the HMO contracting provision, which is, as a district court held, germane to the operation and financing of state government because it tells the DHS commissioner what to do. There are many, many of those provisions. What the gun owners are asking you to do is throw out all of those germane provisions because one discrete provision is not germane.
Okay, let's imagine a hypothetical because I'm afraid I didn't communicate my question well enough for you to understand. What if there were a scenario with a bill where there was no single subject, where there was no common thread, where the title was too broad? What is your best argument as to why, in that scenario, the remedy of severance based on the specific provision challenged is the only remedy that's appropriate?
So if I'm imagining, you know, a subject entitled laws or something that may be on the outer bounds of too broad, I think that there are a couple answers to that. The first is that the title clause exists that may be ripe for a title clause challenge. And the bill could perhaps be invalidated on that grounds. Otherwise, the Minnesota Supreme Court has not confronted a bill like that. They have not provided any instruction for this court. And it is not the case before this court because we do know that the operation and financing of state government is the kind of title that is allowed. It was allowed in Otto, it was allowed in Blanche. And even in Associated Builders, the title and subject of that bill, which did receive its own germaneness analysis to that, was the operation and financing of state and local government. So the operation and financing of state government is a single subject. It is one to which much of this bill hews to. And it maps almost exactly onto the Otto analysis, with the exception of, again, the state conceding that this provision is not germane, while the Otto court found that it was not.
Respondents make an argument in their second brief, the last brief, so you didn't have a chance to do your own third brief. But the argument, I think, is, if I remember right, that apart from the single subject clause, the concept of the general rule regarding severability and when there's unconstitutional provisions is that there's some presumption of not severing a provision unless we can't presume that the legislature would have passed that provision individually or separately. First of all, do you agree with that general law broader than this case? And then secondly, isn't that the case here? I mean, isn't it pretty safe to assume that if this particular act had not gone through as it did, then the particular provisions also would not have?
Sure. Long question. Please,
you're right,
interrupt me if I don't get to all of it. For the first part of the question, I disagree that there is a presumption of non-severability. Actually, in constitutional challenges, it's the exact opposite. The role of the court is to save as much of the statute as possible while complying with the Constitution. That's the general rule. And there is no reason that those general principles shouldn't apply here. I think that sort of gets into the second part of your question, but let me know if I'm not answering it. Under Otto, legislative history is not particularly relevant. It says that in a footnote. But actually, if you look at the legislative history here, the binary trigger ban doesn't implicate a lot of the single subject concerns. It actually had hearings in both houses, multiple different committees, and it actually did pass both houses with plenty of votes to spare. There is actually lots of evidence in the legislative record that this bill was going to pass independently. And for the reasons that I think the amici DFL layout, the legislature ran out of time to do that. But the legislative history is actually clear that this A is severable. You know, appropriations provisions do not depend on the survival of the binary trigger ban. That's one situation where you don't sever, right, when they are so intertwined that you can't sort of excise a part without bringing out the whole. That's just clearly not true here. The district court did sever it. It can be severed. The rest of the bill does not depend on the viability of the binary trigger ban. And here, again, looking at the legislative history, there is just a lot of evidence that the binary trigger ban was going to pass independently without the rest of the bills here. If there are no further questions on remedy, I do want to spend just a little bit of time on
I have one more question about remedy, and that is that if we agree with you and issue an opinion about remedy, as you say, and then if we think ahead, doesn't it basically encourage many, many people and organizations to file these challenges? It seems to me that if we have an act that's so broad, affecting so many people, then we might have hundreds of people coming to Ramsey County District Court and then litigating this individually, piece by piece. And perhaps, you know, the district court judges might reach different conclusions, and then they all come to this court, and we get overwhelmed. I mean, is that the best way to resolve the effect of a violation of the single subject clause?
And is that the best way to do it in a 3 to 4 month period while we wait for codification?
Yes, it certainly could bring multiple challenges, and it could involve multiple challenges. Full candor, the state is now facing multiple challenges to this binary trigger ban, but that, or to the 2024 omnibus bill, but that is how litigation works. Again, we don't throw justiciability out of the window just because we're talking about single subject violations. The general rule is that if you are harmed by a particular provision, you have to come to court, and courts resolve discrete challenges. They do not issue advisory opinions on things not before the court. Many, many provisions of this bill will hold together and be germane to the operation and financing of state government. That's why there haven't been 1,000 challenges, one per page, because much of this bill does hold together. A different rule would throw out perfectly germane provisions that are not before this court without any analysis, without any affected party here briefing them before you. That's just not typically how we do litigation. It does, as Judge Larkin indicated, may I answer your question? I do see I'm out of time. It is one of the reasons that we think codification is a good idea. Because now, you know, candidly, the state has received, I think, 3 challenges in the past couple of weeks to various provisions of the 2024 omnibus bill that, again, everyone has known about for 2 years. Some of them are programs that have been in effect for a year or more and have accrued significant reliance interests. The codification rule, as it's practiced in Iowa, would sort of stop those reliance interests from accruing.
The codification rule, if adopted, would be a new rule here, yes?
It is an issue of first impression before this court, yes.
But does this court have authority to adopt a new rule of law where there is other law we could apply, such as the statute of limitations or the doctrine of latches?
We think that there is a sort of narrow path for this court to do it because it is an issue of first impression. The state has looked very hard to make sure that nobody has presented this argument to either this court or the Minnesota Supreme Court before. We have not found it. This court decides issues of first impression and arguments of first impression frequently. I mean, most appeals in the state end here.
It's an issue of first impression, but instead of a 6-year statute of limitation, we'd have 3 to 4 months. Instead of the doctrine of latches, which takes into account the individual circumstances, it'd be 3 to 4 months. It seems like that's a pretty significant policy decision, which this court normally does not make.
Again, we do think the court has the authority to do it. We understand if you are nervous about doing that in this particular case, given sort of the weighty interests involved, we understand.
But it's not the weighty interests involved. It's the fact that we're an intermediate appellate court. Our duty is to correct law. Our duty is to identify the law and to apply it. And only if there is no law that we could turn to would we then consider adopting a new rule. And here we have latches, as the state has argued. The codification rule is a lot like latches. So who is this court to say, well, latches no longer applies, it's the codification rule?
We do think, to be clear, we think that latches is a fact-specific defense that could apply in some single-subject challenges by itself. We think codification just provides a little more certainty to everyone involved. And I guess I'll end by saying, if this court is nervous about, you know, applying a new doctrine in codification, then what the gun owners are asking you to do should be very nervous, should make you very nervous, because that is not speaking into silence. That is not an issue of first impression. That is a remedy that has been presented to the Minnesota Supreme Court, and the Minnesota Supreme Court has rejected. Thank you. If you have nothing further.
Good morning, Your Honors. Nicholas Nelson of the Upper Midwest Law Center for the plaintiff and cross-appellant. The issue here, I think, is that the Supreme Court has articulated how the single subject clause is supposed to work, and the state wants this court to change that rule. We have broad agreement that the two steps of the test are, one, we're looking for a clear common theme, and then, two, if there is one, you conduct germaneness analysis. Where the parties disagree is how the courts identify the clear common theme, and then what you do if there is not one. As to how you identify a clear common theme, Associated Builders and Otto were both clear. You look for whether it emerges from the provisions of the statute. Associated Builders said that specifically, and then the Otto court cited and parenthetically quoted Associated Builders on that point. The Otto court did not have to do that analysis because nobody raised the argument there, and so the Supreme Court jumped right to germaneness. But the Supreme Court has been clear that that's how it works. The remaining question, all right, we've looked at the statute, we've looked for a clear common theme. What do we do if there is not one? That's where the Women's and Children's Hospital precedent comes into play. Associated Builders said, yeah, that's the situation where you have to strike down an entire statute. We do not want the courts to be in the business of making a guess. What do we, the judiciary, think is the most important single subject in this mass of subjects? So strike down the whole thing and let the legislature do its job and reenact what it thinks is appropriate. That's what the case law says. It all builds out from the Otto decision. Otto, certainly the headliner is germaneness is the test. But of course, you cannot do a germaneness test without answering the question, germane to what? A provision cannot be germane in the abstract. It has to be germane compared to something else. And what is the something else? Otto cites Associated Builders for this point. The something else is the common theme that clearly emerges from the statute's provisions. That leads to the question, all right, if there's no common theme, we look to Associated Builders, we look back to the Women's and Children's Hospital decision, we strike down the whole thing. So the idea that this is an unprecedented...
ask you a couple of questions about the Women's and Children's case. That case is about 100 years old, correct?
It is, yes.
And are you aware of other cases that have cited to that particular case?
There were a couple of them in the decades following. I'm not recalling the names right now.
And the facts of Women's and Children's is not similar to the present case. Is it?
I should amend my previous answer. Of course, Associated Builders extensively discussed Women's and Children's Hospital. That was where it got this rule of, well, maybe we need to strike it down from sometimes. So the facts are different here, yes. I mean, Women's and Children's Hospital involved a statute that was about two things. I think it was licensing maternity hospitals and caring for homeless children. And a maternity hospital said, we don't like this, and the Supreme Court struck down the whole thing, even though the state could have made, and probably did, the exact same argument that it does here, which is, well, wait a minute, you know, caring for homeless children doesn't have to do with maternity hospitals. Didn't matter. The Supreme Court said lots of states do this. You know, when we can't tell what the main theme of a law is, we have to strike down the whole thing. We've emphasized that in our briefing as well. This is the common rule across 40-some states, probably, or many, every state that we know of that has a single subject clause applies a rule like this, where, hey, if we can't see what the common theme is, we have to strike down the whole thing.
Other examples in Minnesota besides Women's and Children's, do you have any?
That's the only one we know of. I mean, again, we think that Associated Builders, they certainly could have said, we're overruling Women's and Children's Hospital. You know, we don't ever want to strike down a whole law. We think the court was rather careful not to do that. They said, well, here are the circumstances where we think that applies, and it's not this one. It is this case, in our view.
Counsel, can I follow up? You said it would be inappropriate for the judiciary to pick, you know, what provisions to keep and which to throw out. That's why we throw out the whole thing. But if we were to just stick with the rule that we only sever the challenge provision, are we really picking what to keep, or are we simply honoring justiciability principles, which say that you can't challenge a law unless you show that you've been subject to injury in fact or you're at risk of immediate harm? In other words, the other cases involving HMO contracting provisions. I mean, surely you wouldn't argue to us that the Gun Owners Caucus had standing to challenge the HMO provisions.
Not to do it separately.
Okay,
but I mean,
so why should the gun owners be able to obtain relief in the form of striking those provisions when they didn't have standing to challenge them in the first place? That's what is concerning me about the idea of striking down the whole bill. not being the Supreme Court, a court that could elect to do that?
Yeah, well, I mean, the first answer is we think the Supreme Court has said striking the whole bill is proper. And so, you know, if that's true, then that kind of, you know, by implication answers this standing concern.
But the last thing the court said on this topic was in Otto, and that was we're limiting the relief to the challenge provision. So how do we get around that language?
Well, I think that's what the court did in Otto. The court didn't say we always have to do that. I mean, the state auditor in Otto did not ask the court to, well, look at the statute's provisions, figure out what the clear common theme was. She just accepted, you know, okay, operation of state government. She argued that was not a valid single subject, but she didn't say, well, that's not what this law is really about. So the Otto court did acknowledge in a case where someone raises that issue, which we are here, the Otto court acknowledged what the standard is. It's the clear common theme emerging from the provisions that Associated Builders said. So that's where we think that rule comes from.
Even if, as you say, the Otto court didn't need to do that analysis because it wasn't expressly challenged, Can we do some comparisons between the act in our case and the act in that case and make any distinctions between them that might indicate whether here we have less of a common theme than in Otto, for example, or more?
I don't think there could be any question there's much less of a common theme in this bill than in Otto. I mean, the state points to different provisions, but also there were a much smaller number of articles. There were a much smaller number of provisions in the Otto bill than there are here. You know, we can't talk about all 1,500 pages at argument, but I think if you look at the way the district court broke it down, this is just much more complex than the statute in Otto was. Now, we don't know what the Supreme Court would have done in Otto had they been asked to hold, is there a common theme for this statute? So I don't want to suggest that Otto was okay and we have to show that it was worse, but I think if we did, we certainly could, and we think we have. I want to emphasize that I think it would be healthy for our state, for the judiciary, and honestly for the legislature, for there to be a clean, full invalidation remedy here. The alternative is not, as we've discussed this morning, the alternative is not everyone goes about our business as usual. The alternative is, I think we all agree, hundreds of lawsuits. Moreover, you know, we may be concerned about, well, are we going to disrupt the law by striking down so much at once? But I think it's likely that the end result of those hundreds of lawsuits is that, as Judge Castro predicted, most of this law is going to get struck down anyway. So the choices really are, well, are we going to have those hundreds of lawsuits that the courts have to slog through? And are we going to leave this structural incentive in place for the legislature to think, we can commit constitutional violations that are too big to fail? If we just pile together enough subjects into a law, the courts will think, oh, we shouldn't strike down the whole thing. I don't think that principle should apply, and I think if the court simply strikes down the whole thing at once, the legislature will realize, gee, we have to confine our legislation to a single subject, and this is unlikely to come up again. I would add that it's not just about the prospect of hundreds of lawsuits. It's also about single subject defenses that are likely to come up every single time the state tries to prosecute or penalize anyone under this statute. I think that shows the practical wisdom of why we do want the courts to be able to look at this all at once. I would add, Judge Larkin, to return to your concern earlier, that general severability principles suggest that this is something the court should be able to look at. I mean, writ large, the idea of severability is that when a statute really needs to all stand or fall together, the courts need to be able to assess that. They need to be able to make that ruling, whether or not it happens that only some of the provisions affect this particular plaintiff. So if that's true, then when a district court makes a ruling of severability, this court needs to be able to perform its normal error correction function and make sure the court got that right. That's what we're asking for. That's what we're asking for here. I would note that just so the court is aware of this, you know, if there are concerns about what does MGOC have standing to do, what are the provisions that affect us, two things to bear in mind. One is that the district court did not actually strike down all of the firearms provisions even in the omnibus bill. You look at pages 4 and 5 of the addendum, the district court discusses that all of Article 36 of the omnibus bill was firearms regulations. The district court struck down only one of them, even though we did ask the district court, hey, if you're not going to strike down the whole bill, please at least strike down all of Article 36. It did not do that. Didn't explain why, but if there's a question of, you know, hey, are we really challenging things that don't affect us, can we get in the door even to this court, I think that at least is something that we would be able to bring up. more broadly, and I think this again shows the wisdom of the rule for sometimes having complete severance in appropriate cases, there certainly are other provisions of this omnibus bill that would or do affect MGOC and its members. They haven't been briefed or litigated, but for instance, as we've talked about, many provisions of this omnibus bill purport to regulate every employment relationship in the state of Minnesota. So if MGOC or if it's any of its members have employees, that's going to affect them. You can point to lots of other things. We could probably, sit all day and come up with others. But the point is the same, which is if MGOC wins this case on grounds that would apply to any provision in the statute, it would be very weird and I don't think appropriate if it and its members had to keep coming back to court and filing basically the same claims using the same legal theories over and over again every time some other provision came up that affected them that hadn't been at issue in this suit. I think that's really, honestly, what would happen, actually, because this is just such a big bill that affects so many different people. Let me close by, unless the court has further questions, of course.
I'm looking at the state's second brief, their reply brief, page 2, footnote 3. So they say that the gun owners have no standing to appeal that issue, the severance issue. I'm just wondering if that is, has standing, I understand Judge Larkin, for example, referred to the concept of standing, justiciability in the context of fashioning a remedy, but is there an independent issue of standing that's been invoked there or mentioned there? And was there any briefing in the district courts, raising a full-on freestanding standing challenge? What do we do with that footnote?
So I'll speak to the footnote in particular and then maybe more broadly to what happened with respect to standing. I was a little surprised to see the footnote because I admit I didn't find it when I just opened the brief, but if I recall correctly, it's saying that this court should not consider whether the single subject of a bill should be ascertained from its title. That's a surprise to me because I thought that's what the state is asking this court to do. If they don't want that to be at issue, if they want to agree, don't look at the title, look at the provisions, we're happy to not litigate that issue. But otherwise, we think they're putting at issue. We think that's their defense to our appeal, and that's why we're trying to raise the issue. As to standing in the district court, we moved for summary judgment before discovery, thinking, well, this was just legal issues. The state said, wait a minute, we're not sure that MGOC or its members have standing to challenge this. So there was some, affidavits filed, some of them under seal because people would have to be admitting to basically committing a crime, violating a criminal statute. So that was done under seal. And Judge Castro did rule that MGOC had established standing, in particular with respect to the binary trigger ban. But of course, he then treated that as standing to challenge the statute more broadly. I'll close by just recapping the themes that I've hit. The state Supreme Court has articulated how single subject challenges are supposed to work. I think we all agree that one of the standards is clear, common theme. That came from Associated Builders. It was cited in Otto. This court should be looking for that. I don't think the state has articulated a persuasive way for the court to do that. I think all they've said is you have to accept whatever is in the title. I also think I heard Ms. Anderson say that it would be okay under the single subject clause for a subject to be laws. That would end single subject litigation, as far as I know. She seems to think it should all come under the title clause. That is inconsistent with the end of Otto, where the Supreme Court says we're firmly committed to continue enforcing the single subject clause. So if we're going to look for a clear common theme anywhere, it has to be in the provisions of the statute. I think it's healthy for our state for this court to do that. I think it's healthy for our state for this court to say if we don't find that clear common theme, we have to strike down the whole thing. I think that's consistent with the kind of severability inquiry that the court will make in other cases, where you're asking, would the legislature have done this? When you have this kind of log rolling, where a bunch of disparate provisions get stitched together, it sure looks like the scholarship has said that what the legislature is doing is trying to add together minority support to come up with the majority. And that's precisely the kind of situation where we don't know what else would have gotten enacted, and therefore the whole thing should get struck down. And of course, the Gun Owners Caucus is indeed affected by other provisions of this bill. So regardless, we think we have standing to be here. Unless there are further questions. Thank you.
I want to start with the gun owner's sort of repeated assertion that there would, you know, it would be good for the state to have full invalidation in this case. And I want to respond both by saying auto and associated builders both stand strongly against that principle, and I'm going to do that by reading from Associated Builders footnote 30. We take this opportunity to observe that both dissents are of the view that severing the offending provision will do little to discourage the legislature from obscuring from public view laws that may be unpopular unless we take the more draconian step of declaring the entire law unconstitutional. We do not perceive that as our responsibility. The thrust of the court's ruling is to honor the legislative process by upholding, where possible, the constitutionality of the law in principle, and constitutionally rejecting only the offending provision. Were we to declare the entire law unconstitutional, we would engage in far greater encroachment on the legislative process than our ruling here. That was from Associated Builders. Otto repeated it by saying that it is not our job to look at provisions not before us. This is the purpose of litigation, is to provide full relief to the parties in front of us. And while the gun owners are now saying we are affected by other provisions in this bill, they only challenged the binary trigger ban. Those declarations that were submitted to prove their standing only dealt with binary triggers. There is no evidence in the record on summary judgment that they are affected or have standing to challenge any provision other than the binary trigger ban. Given that, this court's role is the same role that the court in Otto took unto itself, which is to analyze the challenged provision and determine if it was germane, to sever the provision if it is not, as it is not here. That's the state of the law. Judge Rasmussen, your colloquy about Women's and Children's Hospital, that is the only case in the state of Minnesota that has ever entertained full invalidation, and you're right, it's a very different situation here. I would also point out that contemporaneous cases to Women's and Children's say that the rule is severance whenever possible. And the gun owners haven't told you why it is not possible to sever the binary trigger ban from the rest of this bill. It is possible. Judge Castro did it below.
If we sever, then can we confidently say that what's left is an act that complies with the single subject clause?
You can be confident that there are other parties challenging other provisions of that to make that determination, parties with standing. So that, again, one example that the gun owners bring up a lot is the combat sports provisions, which are kind of fun to pick on because it sounds a little wonky. If you actually look at those provisions, which nobody has done in this case or in the United Health Group case because no party has standing to challenge them, they actually tell the DLI commissioner to take pretty specific steps. That could be germane. What you are doing by limiting your review to the challenged provision is A, complying with Supreme Court precedent, and B, complying with normal litigation principles. Full relief to the gun owners is severing the provision that they have established harms them. That's the binary trigger ban.
You earlier made reference to, I think, what you called the title clause.
Yes.
Which shall be expressed in the title. I guess I had kind of thought of that as part of the single subject clause. You're saying it's a separate clause. Is there a separate body of case law that interprets that second part of the...
There is. Title clause challenges are distinct from single subject challenges. Obviously, they are in the same provision and play off each other a little bit, but... There was a title clause challenge in this case originally, and that has now been dropped on appeal. They are two separate claims.
And isn't the purpose of the title clause, though, to notify people what's in the bill?
Yes.
And I've looked at the title. It covers about two pages of text, single space. And I've looked at the reviser's style manual to see, you know, how we come up with this title. We have sort of the purpose of the act, then we list all of the subjects that are covered under that purpose, and then we list all of the amendments, changes, additions. And so, you know, you end up with these titles where it's like, well, can I find this topic in this long list? And most times you can. So what constitutes a title violation then? How would the title clause satisfy the concerns here if you could look at the title and all of its components and say, yes, it notifies people that this binary trigger ban is in this law?
As a hypothetical, I mean, I think our legislature does a pretty good job putting all the subjects or sort of all the topics in that title. They don't have to. I mean,
but they did here.
They did here. So that is
where
why
would the title violation be in this case?
There wouldn't be a title violation in that case. That's why the state has prevailed on every title clause challenge in this case so far. I mean, but you could certainly imagine a world where
they left
the topic out.
But I thought you said earlier that the proper challenge here would be a title clause violation rather than single subject.
I misunderstood. I was responding to your hypothetical about, you know, a subject that was constitutionally too broad, which I don't think is the situation here, because again, Otto, Associated Builders, and Blanche all say that this sort of title is constitutionally permissible.
What was the title in Otto?
State Government Operations.
Okay, and here, what's the title?
Financing and Operation of State Government.
Aren't those two subjects?
I don't think so. I think, again, the title...
That's not what Otto had before it.
Otto, I think financing and operation are sort of two sides of the same coin. You can't really operate something without funding it. Associated Builders, again, did have that.
And you can't really operate and fund and enforce criminal laws. Does that mean all criminal laws fall under operations and financing?
No, again, I think we've conceded in this case that a criminal law does not fall under the operation and financing of state government. But Blanche was operations and organization of state government.
Was that title challenged as being too broad? I think the only case I recall in which there was actually a challenge to the title as being too broad to pass constitutional muster, I believe is what Justice Gilday said. Are there any other cases where people actually went after the title and said this title is too broad and a court considered that?
I'm not sure if specifically they have... very early cases, like the state ex rel Pearson, I think, did sort of say that's just a very, very broad subject, and the answer from the Supreme Court was broad subjects are fine. I think the one at issue there was transportation. I know,
but again, it's just transportation, not transportation and financing.
Again, Judge Larkin, I would say that Blanche, again, did germaneness to organization and operation, and again, Associated Builders was the operation and financing of state and local government. It is the legislature's prerogative to define its bill. I'm not sure that the word and necessarily means that there are two subjects.
But in Associated Builders, the title wasn't challenged as being too broad.
It was. Well, there was a title clause challenge in the case.
Okay, but does the opinion address the argument, as it did in Otto, that there's an allegation here that the title itself is too broad to pass constitutional muster? We find that this title is fine.
I don't think squarely, but again, I think state government operations and financing and operation of state government are functionally the same thing. There are no further questions.
Ms. Larkin, may I ask one more question? Mm-hmm. Ms. Anderson, I have a question about that footnote, which I mentioned to Mr. Nelson. I guess, what are you asking us to do there exactly?
Yeah, so for that footnote, I do want to clarify, we do think severance is properly before this court. That was properly appealed. Our point was that Judge Castro agreed with the gun owners on the framework. Judge Castro did sort of say that the title isn't good enough, I'm going to look at all these provisions, and then resulted in severance anyway because he felt he was bound by the Supreme Court to do so. So we don't think that the framework is properly before you, the sort of how you got there or how you get to what the title is, because the gun owners prevailed on that below and we didn't appeal on that basis.
So you're not suggesting the gun owners don't have standing to challenge the remedy and to make the arguments they're making today?
I think it's splitting hairs a little bit, I'll admit, that we think that they do have standing to challenge severance as the remedy, but not the framework or the analysis of how you determine a bill subject, because Judge Castro agreed with them on that point.
Sounds like you're parsing out different steps in the analysis. Is that a fair way of characterizing it? Saying that they can't challenge this step, but they can make arguments that logically come before and after?
I think narrowly we would say that Judge Castro agreed with them on that point. So whether we agree with them is not particularly relevant. They cannot appeal something that they want on below.
Are you saying they can't raise any issues about the constitutionality decision that was made by Judge Castro because you haven't challenged Judge Castro's determination that there is a single subject clause violation? The only issue is remedy.
Yes. Okay. And then obviously we appealed our codification and political question arguments, but those are different.
You're not asking us to dismiss the cross appeal for lack of standing?
No. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, that concludes the court's calendar. We thank you for your arguments and the briefing. You'll have our decision within 90 days.